Welcome to the Good Endeavor Business Show, where we explore profound meaning behind our work. I'm Mark McDaniel, along with my friend and co-host, Bobby Harrington. We're embarking on a journey to discover how everything we do in business and life, big or small, carries inherent significance. Join us as we delve into the heart of small business, aiming for excellence and service in every step of the way. Welcome to another episode of the Good Endeavor Business Show. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Bobby Harrington, and we've got a special guest today, Brian Beers. I've actually been following Brian quite a while on Twitter and have been influenced, so I'm officially influenced by an influencer. And he's got an incredible podcast. He has several Midas locations. Is that right, Brian?
Yep.
Several Midas locations. And he just launched another franchise called The One Painter. And just lots of tips and tricks around what to look for in a franchise, why franchises make sense versus starting your own. Lots of education around that. So, Brian, I'm specifically super excited about today just because we recently invested in a franchise and really interested to talk to you, man. So welcome to the show.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, you're welcome. So give us a little background. Like, how did you get into franchising? Is this something you bought into, or did you just kind of start with one and kick it off from there?
Yeah, so it was actually a family business. My dad got into Midas in the 70s. You know, he was in it for over 30 years, kind of him and my granddad started with one, and then they grew it to six or so locations, kind of all in the Philadelphia area, doing it, you know, for 30 plus years. I joined the business after college, and, you know, it was 08, 09, 10 had been pretty rough on the business, and they were looking to sell, retire, just kind of move on. Business was basically not profitable then, and they'd been tired. And so I joined the business, and, you know, I traveled around the country. I learned from other franchisees, tried to figure out what was working to see if I could, you know, get this thing turned around. And, you know, we started having success. We started putting some of these best practices in place. And so I did that for years. And, you know, eventually kind of took over the company, decided in 2016 that, you know, I wanted to make more money. I didn't own anything. I was just kind of an employee. And, you know, so my brother had joined by then. And together, you know, we got a loan and went out and bought two other locations kind of in the Philly market. You know, ran it all as one company, but, you know, kind of had this different equity split. And then we just kept rolling profits. You know, the next year we took the money we made on those two, and we bought another one. And then in 18, we bought another two, and we opened a location. 2019, we did it again, and, you know, and kind of so on. And, you know, today, you know, that business, you know, my brother and I own the whole thing. We bought out our dad and uncle a couple years ago. And yeah, we have 33 locations. We did $42 million last year in revenue. You know, this year I expect, you know, over 50 million. And a lot of it, you know, is just through that compound growth, right? And yeah, so we learned a lot of lessons. We've kind of figured out what works, what doesn't. You know, we've invested in other franchises too that failed. And so now we kind of take all those lessons and now we're kind of building this infrastructure. And so, yeah, we expanded into That One Painter, just a painting franchise. And we've kind of got this roadmap for kind of building out multiple lines in the franchise space that I think leverages our capital, our talent, kind of the vision and the experience we've got.
When you say you bought locations, that doesn't mean you bought the rights and then you opened the location. You bought an existing location, right?
Existing, yeah. Almost all of ours or existing shops, you know, in that brand. You know, a lot of older owners want to get out. Kids aren't involved. Some of these things are not, you know, not profitable when we buy them or barely make money. Some of them are and do well. And so selling to another franchisee is the easiest path. So yeah, a lot of these, you know, I'm the only buyer. We do seller financing. You know, we can create these really good win-win scenarios for people.
Ask, like, how do banks see that? So from what I understand about franchises is banks love profitable franchises because it's a proven process, a proven brand, and after you get one paid off, then it's a lot easier to get money to open the second location. But if you're buying potentially unprofitable locations, it sounds like your path was owner financing, right?
Yeah, we only went one time to a bank, and that was that first loan. And those were for two profitable, you know, locations. Everything after that has been owner financed. You know, we're talking millions of dollars worth too. And so there's a couple, you know, benefits of why, like, why would a seller do it? Number one, you know, like you said, there's an issue where, you know, maybe they're just not profitable or they barely make money. And it's like, you know, and then now you got to get tax returns and you got to justify all this and what's the business plan. And, you know, a lot of times the seller, you know, sometimes these people just want out, like, and they're okay. They want speed. And like, we can get a seller finance deal 35 to 45 days. I can get it done. It can be pretty quick. You know, and I have a really good, like, legal team. We've done this a bunch. You know, you deal with a bank, it could be 6 months, right? Like, dragging it through. So sometimes speed's important, and that's why they do it. You know, people want to do deals with people they know, like, and trust, right? And in a franchise system, it's like this closed network. And so, you know, I am, like, intentional about being known. I participate on the committees. I'm, like, active in a lot of the local stuff. You know, I'm trusted in that. You know, I want to help people too. Like, I help other franchisees. We share ideas. They can see, you know, rankings. You know, we're a top performer. And so if they're going to sell to me and, like, you know, they want to know that I'm a good performer and that I can drive the sales and ultimately pay them back. You know, if I'm at the bottom of the list, you know, it's like, well, this guy's going to run this thing straight into the ground, right? You know, in some ways they believe investing in me and, like, earning interest for me and they be the bank is a better deal for them than taking that money and putting in the stock market or, you know, whatever, what else they do with
it.
And what's the alternative?
Right?
Yeah. Or they just don't sell it, yeah. You know, and they keep operating it however it goes. And then, you know, a lot of these people have other, you know, they've got a job. They look at retirement. Some of them own, you know, multiple businesses and, you know, maybe the money is, like, not that important. It's more the mental, like, strain on it, right? That, like, payroll every week, or this guy is going to quit, or, like, you just keep giving raises and raises to keep people, right? Because you're trying to, like, not rock the boat. And, you know, and sometimes we can come in and we can relieve all that, and they sell it to us, and we keep all the people, or we try to keep all the people, and, you know, grow up from there.
That's awesome, man. Congrats, Brian. It seems like you've had a ton of success and you don't look very old. So, and not all that many years. So, man, I want to circle back to a couple of things that you said. You already shared kind of a lot of really good stuff there. One, you said at the very beginning, you and your brother, I guess, started implementing some of these best practices. And a lot of times when I hear that, it's like, okay, there's best practices in general that apply to any business, that apply to any type of leadership. And then there's very industry specific, you know, best practices. So maybe talk about that along maybe those two lines, what some of those best practices were. I'm sure you've learned many more over the years as you've gone along, but maybe some of those general leadership best practices, and then maybe some of those very industry specific best practices.
So a lot of it had to do, in my case, you know, and this was, you know, 10 years ago now at this point, but it's evolving, right? It's constant. Is, you know, I was in a business that, you know, my dad and uncle, you know, did a great job building it, but, you know, they were kind of those guys I was just talking about who were kind of, like, on their way out, right? And so they sometimes had people in there who, you know, culturally, they showed up every day and they turned the key and they, like, punched the clock and they were reliable, but they weren't performers, right? And so kind of my thing when I came in was like, all right, well, we got to find people. We had to change the culture, right? That we need motivated, driven people who want to win and not just show up every day. And so a lot of it, you know, that I was learning from other people was, you know, how do we find these people? How do we vet these people? Like, what are the questions during the interview process? What kind of experience should I be looking for? Redesigning compensation plans and the plans they had, they were very driven just based on sales, which is good for driving sales. But, you know, if you sell a thing for $1,000, it costs us $900. Like, it's crap, right? We don't make any money on that. And so a lot of it was like, how do we shift it? So we shifted it to be, you know, more of a gross profit driven plan, which, you know, they have a ton of control over. In our business, because they can control all the pricing. It was learning, like, what are compensation plans that other guys use that work? An industry specific one was, you know, we have mechanics, right? And then it's the same problem with mechanics. How do we attract talented ones? How do we retain them? How do we give them, you know, compensation plans that reward for performance while also, you know, A, the company can afford, and B, is making sure that we're aligned, like, on, you know, the core values that we have. You know, so a lot of the talks were about people, right? Because we're in the people business. Every franchise is in the people business, just happens to do a service, right? So we're in the people business. We just happen to fix cars. And so a lot of the topics are around attracting talent. You know, what kind of benefits can we offer that same thing that that makes sense, but then we can, the company can afford.
How's your role changed over the years? Like, you've gone from pretty small business owner to now you're talking about $50 million in revenue. I mean, that's pretty significant.
Yeah. So I view it as like this stair step approach, right? And so when I started, I was 22 years old. Like I was an employee in the business. I ran the store. Like I was a store manager or assistant manager. And then I got promoted to be a store manager. You know, then eventually I became like the district manager, right? So it was me and then kind of the six store managers reported to me. So I eventually hired them, fired them, trained them, like, you know, end to end, you know, own the process, you know, but then eventually it was like, you know, and I was also helping kind of run the back office and the financing and you know, all the stuff with growing. And then you kind of have to say, well, like, I want to grow more, but I am so busy. I take 100 phone calls a day. How the heck am I going to have time to go out and do it? So then, you know, always I look to how do I replace myself?
Uh-huh.
And I knew that if I could hire somebody who could take over kind of that district manager role and be the main point of contact, then I could focus on growth. So all part of that plan, we bought those first two stores that were like, you know, kind of my brother and I's, was all right. So now we're bringing in another 200, 300K a year, whatever it was. Let's go ahead and use, you know, 100 grand of that or whatever to hire a district manager who can then take over my role. And so like, yes, like maybe I'm going to make a little bit more, less money than if I didn't do that. But now I've got time where I can go out and continue to build kind of the relationships and drive this thing forward. And so then, you know, then I became, then it was like, all right, now that we have buy more stores. Now we have two district managers, each oversee whatever, 10 stores each. But then that allows me to then go out and do another deal. And so then eventually I became the COO in a sense. So I had four district managers reporting up to me and kind of realized that, hey, if I want to go to the next level, I need to hire somebody who's better at this than me. And so I went out, we found this guy hired him as a COO. Background was his military special forces. I was his first civilian job at a retirement from the military. And, you know, he's a rock star. Within 3 months, he kind of took over everything I had done. He does it way better than me at it because he's way more organized and focused. And then that allows me to continue to look at the bigger picture. And so, you know, at every level, my goal is to replace myself. And a lot of people get stuck because they don't do that.
Brian, I think there's this perception when you buy into a franchise, like you mentioned early on in the call, that some of the franchises you bought weren't profitable. And this pick, I think this carries over on some of Bobby's questions. And so, you know, you went out and you talked to these franchises that were very profitable, it sounds like, and you learned from them on how to do this. So the perception of a franchise is like, man, this should all kind of be built in. This playbook on how to do this the most successful way should be built in. Is this just something that some franchises choose not to take the franchisor up on, or is this just something that at some point in the time, like, you're just going to have to be self-accountable and take the reins?
I think it's a combination of both. One, it's that, you know, every franchise is a business. Like, you're a business owner that just happens to operate a franchise. And so some people are good business owners. Some people just aren't cut out for it, right? Like, to be a good business owner, you have to hold yourself accountable. You got to like hire great people. You got to lead other people. You can't be like playing pity games and acting like a child. And so like, some people just aren't cut out for it, right? Maybe they've got the money. Maybe they were successful in their you know, corporate America deal, but like, they just aren't cut out, or it just takes them a while to get it, right? So that's like first and foremost, you know, every franchisee is a business owner. We just happen to play within a sandbox in the franchise system. I think that's like really key, and a lot of people miss, and they think, oh, your franchisee means like you're like quasi-corporate, and like everything you do, it's like to make the franchisor more money, which is like literally the opposite of that. Like, I could care less. Like, if my margins doubled, if I did less sales, but I doubled my margin and I make the same or more money, like, I'm totally okay with that. Even if I'm paying less in royalties, right? Like, because I think I wake up every day, how do I improve my business? How do I make more money? I really don't think at all about Midas or the brand or what's good for them, or like, that's not even a, it's not even a thing. So I think you're operating a business. Now the franchise provides these like training wheels in a sense that you've got this like business model, you know, a lot of them handle the marketing for you. A lot of them show you what to do. You know, execution still comes down to you. You know, the best franchises make this process as smooth and easy as possible. you know, the ones that aren't great, you know, maybe they've got a loose framework, but a lot of it's on you. Even in Midas, like, you know, the power of Midas is that we have a brand name, right? And people know it. That, like, honestly, that is the biggest power of it. But the average person, like, it's a highly complex business, right? With mechanics, and we work on all different types of vehicles, and like, there's a ton of moving parts. It's really great in a lot of ways, and we've had a ton of success with it. It's also not like, it's not everybody's successful. And even in this brand, 66%, two out of three owners are single store operators, right? Because of, in theory, because of the complexity. Versus in the painting business, like, that's one of the reasons we bought into it, is it's a lot simpler, right? We're putting paint on walls. Like, there's a lot less things that can go wrong than in the automotive repair, cars falling off lifts and all kinds of stuff.
Totally. So how have you balanced, like you mentioned, the business is kind of, there's been this compound growth over time. And, you know, as a business grows, I mean, there's multiple places you can put that money. Obviously, any entrepreneur, business owner doesn't want to be poor. So at some point, you want to pay yourself. You know, there's the wanting to invest in further growth of the business, which it sounds like you guys have done a lot of. There's also, you know, needing to just invest in the stability of the business too. You know, just to, you know, weather kind of the storms of the economy and all of that. So what did you have a strategy for how to kind of what that compound growth flywheel profits, you know, look like over time? Or did you just kind of feel it out as you guys went?
Yeah. So, you know, my brother's my partner in it. And so, like, you know, we have a similar philosophy, which was, you know, the best place we can invest our money is back into the business. And so during the last 3 years, you know, we've grown from 12 stores to 33. You know, a lot of the money, like, we made, you know, we follow the profit first kind of playbook to a degree, if you guys are familiar with that. So we have, McHalwitz, and I interviewed him on my podcast a couple months ago, or a year ago. So we have multiple bank accounts. You know, we shift money to a tax account because our quarterly taxes keep growing. So we kind of estimate 12 months out what we think we're going to make, and we move money there so we won't get whacked. We have a profit account, so we're constantly shifting money over. You know, our model is, like, we have a certain amount of money we want in our operating account, and anything over that gets swept. And so, yeah, we kind of build up reserves there. And then, you know, we kind of have an eye on what our plan is. Not, like, during the growth phase, we had a bunch of targets. So we said, hey, we want to grow. And so we were basically just building up reserves in this profit account to then redeploy. So we never really took it as distributions. We just kept it in this like separate account that we'd fund. So that's how we started the painting business, right? We knew we needed a couple hundred grand for that. And so that's where we pulled it from. Kind of over the next 12 months, as we look, like, we've acquired almost all the locations we think we can acquire kind of in our current market. And so now we're looking at similar thing of, hey, where can we deploy this? We're looking at real estate, triple net, you know, stuff to buy. We're looking at, you know, maybe another franchise if we can run it this in the similar model. And so, yeah, you know, or we just take it as cash. And honestly, we go out and we find, you know, I have a bunch of friends in who run different, you know, private equity deals that I invest in, whether it's in, you know, multifamily syndications, whether it's I'm in this coffee business that's going public, a whole bunch of other stuff. So I look for really good operators that I believe have a unique position, and I invest with them as well.
Do you think it's advisable, like, say somebody's tuning in and they're looking at their first location, but they have aspirations to do what you've done? If they can afford it, is it advisable to hire an operator from the very start so you can take yourself out of the day-to-day, or is it worthwhile to be in the day-to-day for a while?
Yeah, I think it, you know, it all depends on the person. Even so for that one painter, for me, you know, my model is that where I hired the regional director, his job is to kind of really, like, hire the guys, train the guys, run the calls every single day, like, do site visits with them. You know, he's not selling the work, but he is in the role of, you know, he's leading the business every day. So the thing is, someone has to do that work, number one. Sometimes people think, like, there's this whole ops, like, I'm going to keep my job or whatever, and I'm going to, like, buy this franchise and it's just going to run. The truth of it, someone has to be in that role. So it's either you. So some people, they say, hey, I want to learn this thing. I'm going to do that role in the beginning, and I'm going to learn it. Other people, you know, may say, hey, I'm gonna hire that role because of, you know, whatever reason. But you still need to be involved. It's still a business that needs, like, that guy still needs, for me, needs coaching. So I talk to him right now. I mean, we're just getting this thing off the ground. I talk to him every day. you know, I'm on the daily huddles, like me and him are bouncing ideas off of each other. So, you know, if I didn't, you know, if I didn't have Midas and that was my first thing, I probably would do it like myself. And then, but then I'd replace myself. If you want to go quicker, faster, then yeah, hire the guy. And like, you know, we bought 13 territories. We have three launched. Like our goal is to get another two spun up in a couple months once we, you know, once we just like figure the basic stuff out. And then, I mean, if this thing works as we think it's going to work, I mean, we're going to have all 13 open within, you know, 18 months or whatever it is. And so to do that, I need help. Like I wouldn't be able to do that all myself either way. Right. And so, part of it is I need to build the team to help do that. It's personal preference, but it's also like, you know, yeah, do you have the money to hire somebody good? If you're going to hire somebody who's just like the lower level, cause you're trying to save on payroll. Like, I think it's a terrible idea.
Yeah. Man. I've heard you mention, I mean, along those lines, I've heard you mention your specific comp plan that you implemented. Like it's like 33% profit or something along those lines. Do you mind?
Yeah. So that's for our store managers. Yeah. So this is a plan that we're just rolling out. And this is for Midas, where it's a profit sharing plan for her best, you know, store managers. And so the idea is, you know, they earn their total comp will be basically a third of the store's profits, you know, after, you know, we allocate money for taxes. And so, you know, a good store manager, I mean, we want to put them on the path that our best store managers can make over 200 grand, you know, running an automotive repair shop, you know, with like no college degree, no equity. Like it's all, you know, but they have this huge path just to like treat people right and like get these cars in and out and do an awesome job. And so, you know, we believe that, you know, not only does it reward our guys we have that can get it to that level, because at that level, like we're making way more money if I can pay a guy 200 grand to run it, right? But it's also super attractive, right? If I can go to then find who are the best store managers at our competitors, and we can show them a path of, hey, you join us, you know, you bring your team with us, with you, like we have this framework that will pay you significantly more. And so we're doing that for, so as a company, we're flipping our philosophy to be more profit driven. And so we're starting, you know, my COO is profit driven. We're moving our district managers over to that plan. Our store level managers for the Midas business who reach certain qualifications get on this plan. You know, everybody's aligned then, rather than just sales, which we all know that sales are just the first part of it. So
Brian, can you talk a little bit about, you mentioned a lot of these deals are like owner finance deals, and like I know just where the economy is and interest rates, and I don't know if there'll be more owner finance deals in the future, but it seems like the likelihood, you know, is pretty high. And plus you have the baby boomer generation retiring, and, you know, Mark's in a bunch of stuff, but even in real estate, I mean, there's lots of owner finance type stuff happening right now. Can you just talk about, like, I don't know, like how you approach that? What are some of the selling points for the person financing it for you? What's some of the benefits? Just kind of all that, super interesting.
Yeah, so we approach it totally different, I think, what most people do, which is, you know, we talk about it, you know, as cash flow. Like, here's how much, like we make the offer, we say, this is what we're going to give you down, and this is how much we're going to pay you per month for how many months, right? So we negotiate on those three things, down payment, monthly payment, number of payments. So it'd be like, we'll give you $25,000 down and whatever, two grand a month for the next 10 years. And, you know, you can do the math to think, all right, it's, you know, 24,000, 240,000 plus, you know, it's 260,000 total payments. So we would negotiate on that point. And then, cause then they'll say, well, I want more money down, or I want more per month, or like, you know, I want to extend this thing out. Once we come to terms on like cash flow, then we'll back into what's a purchase price, what's an interest rate. You know, we'll come up with a crazy interest rate that's like, you know, 3.9752, whatever the calculator says. We don't approach it as, hey, we're going to give you $350,000 and, you know, we want you to, you know, 20% down and hold it for X years, 7%, right? We do the reverse, because most of these business owners think in terms of cash flow. They don't necessarily think of like what's interest rate and amortization periods and all this like finance lingo. So we found that, at least with the seller, the population of sellers that we're working with, is an easier way to communicate it. And then, you know, our goal is to shift, you know, in this business as much into assets as we can, right? So when you buy a business, you've got goodwill, you've got assets, and you've got inventory. And so, you know, from a tax perspective, as much that can go into assets are great, because then we can, you know, we can bonus depreciate it and we can wipe out tons of income from that. Rather than goodwill, you know, it's linear. It's a linear amortization period. And so, like, us knowing that, because we've done this deal so many times, like, when we're looking to buy somebody, you know, maybe we have to give up on payments, whatever, but we know that, you know, we kind of have in our back pockets to say, hey, well, listen, you know, we want to make sure we can, you know, whatever, can get 80 or 90% of this thing as assets and not as goodwill. Tougher if you're buying a business that literally doesn't have assets, like we're buying the painting company, there's literally no assets. But in our business, it's asset heavy. So
a lot of the franchisees, do they own the real estate that the Midas location is in?
For Midas, no, not really. The corporate controls a lot of it. REITs control a lot of it. You know, they're all triple net leases. It's in a very attractive thing to own. Like, we're literally responsible for almost everything. What's the benefit to the seller? How do we pitch it? A couple things. One is they get deferred tax gains. So any capital gains that they would have, they get to spread it out over the life of the loan. So spread that payment over 200,000 or, you know, 20 years or 10 years or whatever. They get to earn interest like the bank would. They also get a lot of the same protections the bank would. And, you know, it's kind of more secure. And sometimes that's their only option, right? They want to sell to me, you know, or they want to sell to you, whoever it is, and you're the best buyer for the business. And they know you're going to treat the people right and you're going to give everybody opportunity. And we just approach it as, hey, this is how we do it. Like, you want us to buy this thing, you know, maybe we give them a low cash offer that's like almost insulting, or, you know, we can do the seller finance deal. We'll pay you over the course of this time. And we've got 7 other people we've done this deal with as references. Like, it's super easy. I mean, if it's your first deal and you have no track record, probably gonna be a little bit harder, but once you get one or two under your belt, I think it becomes a lot easier.
Man, I'm thinking through how you've transformed some of these businesses, these franchisees who have done this for a while, and they basically bought into the same franchise that your father did. And for whatever reason, their paths went a different way. If there was one thing that you had to pick out why somebody would be successful in that business and somebody's not, you mentioned people and culture, but like, even peeling back the onion even farther, is there one thing or a couple things that you can pick out that is just obvious that people should be doing?
A lot of it's that. I mean, one of our best success stories was a store we bought a year ago where the same manager has been there for 10 years. The same team, core team, has been there for years. Same owner forever. They did $1 million in sales for literally the last 8 years. $1 million every single year, plus or minus whatever, a couple percent. We get in there, the next, which is 80,000 a month, right? 20,000 a week. Then the second week we're in there, we do like 35,000. And like, we finished the year at 1.6 million. And like, I know we're gonna break 2 million this year with the exact same manager, literally the same exact manager, the same core group of people. And so like, we come in and we ask him like what changed? Like, you know, it's the same guy. It's the same place. We didn't even do any marketing. And he's, and you know, for him, it was like, you know, we opened his mind to like having a growth mindset. This is like his words, that he realized like how much more was possible. That before it was just like him and another store. And so this old 75-year-old lady, she was like never there, you know, and he like, you know, He believed in like what he was doing was good, and that's just the most the store can do. We get in there, and we, you know, we've got stores doing 2 million, 2.5 million, like, you know, we're all the store that breaks 3 million this year, and say, hey, listen, like, you can do all this, right? Like, like, this is no different than what you can do. And so him changing his mindset on what's possible, number one. B, like, all their techs were on like an hourly pay plan that, like, whether they hustled and, you know, or sat back, they made the same amount of money. We stick them on a pay plan that's, you know, we pay for performance. So if they hustle and they like get the cars done quicker and we say yes to more customers, they make more money. And so he could sense an instant change in his people to work the same amount of hours and double their pay, which motivated them. And then he was motivated. And so, and everybody wins, like we can help more customers. And so that's like a big part of it is I believe it's, we need to open our guys' minds up to what's possible. And a lot of times we've got this like 4 minute mile mentality where we're just like, this is just how it is. This is how it's always going to be, like, you know, and then we can come in, especially as a company gets larger, it's easier for us to point at people who've done it. And like, we can bring our guys together and they can speak it too about how this is how I did it. Not, you know, not just me talking as like in theories. Right. And so that becomes easier as you grow because you've got these success stories to share and inspire people. So anyway, that's, and that applies to any business, right? Whether that's Midas or painting or, you know, the chicken business or whatever, it's like, hey, this is what's possible. And once people realize there's a path forward, it makes it so much easier for them to follow it.
Man, you're speaking our language.
For real. Yeah, that's cool. That's an awesome story. I'm going to steal that and use that at some point. I would love to just kind of peel back. You know, when you talk to entrepreneurs, obviously we want to make money and be successful, but, you know, typically most people don't want to do that to the expense of everything else in their life, you know? So there's some component of winning at life and not just winning in business. But what do you, like, what drives you and your brother in terms of the business, you know, in terms of the future, in terms of your vision?
Yeah. I mean, I love it. I mean, for me, it's my hobby, right? Like I try to play golf, but like I usually prioritize business. Like for me, it's like, I just like really enjoy it, you know? And so I think that's part of just me. And I've always been like that from a kid, like just reading business books and like learning about and how people will make money. And like, so for me, I just love it. And it's personally fun. I like learning and challenging myself. So learning new things. So it's like, you know, it's the game of business that I think I really enjoy. And so part of it is like the game of how do I replace myself? How do I find somebody and how do I train them? How do I like, you know, even now, you know, I'm building this audience on social media and, you know, trying to help inspire others. And like, I mean, I knew nothing about this stuff 2 years ago, right? And I grew, you know, Twitter's from 200 people to 21,000, I think I'm at now. And so now it's like, well, how do I impact even more people? And how can I do it all? And I just like love learning. And so that's part of it. I prioritize, you know, my family. I think, you know, I'm done every day at work by like, I'm home usually by 4:30. Like I take my daughter to school every morning. Like I, you know, I've been very intentional too about, you know, as I grow, I want to make sure that, you know, my family is there and comes first. And one of the things that helps it though, is as the business gets bigger, it's easier because then you have more payroll to hire better people. Right. And I think the problem when the business stays small is like, you just can't afford it. And then, so for me years ago, that was like, I was working 60, 70 hours. Like I was, you know, always distracted and like, you know, but I knew that if I could build the business to the point that I could hire the people, that would free me up. And I think sometimes you think, oh, as the business gets bigger, you have more stuff, like it's going to suck more time away. But in reality, if you do it right, you know, it's the opposite where I can hire better people. As long as I don't micromanage, I give them responsibility and I, you know, do it right, then my time's even more free to invest in the things that I, you know, want to do.
That's great. That's great. Hey, one real quick follow-up, because I think it'd be super helpful for people and even for myself. I've noticed like some entrepreneurs make the shift to like social media and growing that like look very easy and they're very successful at that. And then other entrepreneurs seem to just like struggle like crazy with the whole social media front, almost like it's like just learning a new language and they just can't seem to master it. So any tips or tricks there? I mean, you just said in 2 years, you went from basically nothing to 21,000 followers on Twitter, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's something you have to learn like anything else. Like I've invested into like these personal brand coaching things, right? I've read all like Nicholas Cole and Dickie Bush have a ton of great stuff about how to write online. It's constantly changing. So it's something you definitely have to like practice and work on. I've invested a ton of time into it as well, but it's a muscle. Like the more you do it, the better you get at it. And yeah, some days like you think you're going to write like this killer thing, everyone's going to love it. And then nobody reads it. And like, but then you realize, like, well, then you learn mainly from these other guys telling you, but it's fine. Then like, it's not that the content's bad. It's like the hook's bad. Right. And so then you're like, all right, let me go back. Let me like same content. Let me just like change up the hook. And then you do it. And then, you know, it does great. So I think it's understanding that A, you know, everybody starts at the same place, which is zero, and you just got to learn it. And B, like just because something doesn't hit, like nothing's like personal. I think that the biggest challenge that I think a lot of people struggle with, like, is everything feels so personal. And now, like, if you put something out there or you share a story and people like give you a bunch of shit about it, like it's like they're personally attacking you, right? And so a lot of people, you know, I mean, I've done it too, where it's like, yeah, I share my origin story, right? It's a family business. I've grown it obviously significantly, but then, you know, you get the haters who, you know, try to put you down on stuff, and you can't let that get to you, because I think the biggest way you add value is to be authentic and to be true. And I think I do my best to stay in that lane versus, you know, being all hype and, you know, whatever. But to be true and authentic, right, is there's some vulnerability there, and you have to be okay with, you have to be able to ignore all the bullshit stuff, because you're going to help like 100 times more people than the one or two people that give you, you know, crap about it.
I will say, you don't have, like, it would be easy. I mean, I can imagine some of the folks out there would say, oh, you inherited your daddy's business or whatever. You don't have that air about you at all. Like, you don't seem like you're trying to live up to something for dad. I mean, you seem like you, like, hey, I own this. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to grow it. And this is what we've done. Like, there doesn't seem to be that idea of like, man, I'm doing this all just so I can make dad proud, sort of thing.
Yeah. And I know that, right. And I know the truth. It's just sometimes, you know, in the Twitterverse or any of the short term stuff, you know, people, they only see the surface level, or they see the story that they want to believe, or they're victims, right. In the world hates them. And so then they blame everybody else, you know, for their, you know, situation. Right. And so then it's just all part of it. But if you put yourself out there and you want to actually build, you got to be authentic, which means, you know, you got to share stuff in your point of view, which, you know, like, you know, that other people are going to, you know, say mean things about it. It's a question of like, are you willing to, you know, deal with that or not?
It's okay.
So, or just be surface level. Right. But then at surface level doesn't get you anywhere. So,
go ahead, Bobby. You look like you got something burning.
Oh, no, man. I was just going to say, awesome. I feel like we're at a good point in the podcast. I feel like this has just been like super, super helpful from people that are, you know, maybe just starting out to trying to grow to the point of where you're at, which is awesome, man. Mark, I mean, any last kind of, you know, topics to dive into or things that you want to hit?
No, I think that's it, man. We're coming up on about 45 minutes. So Brian, this has been, I actually have a lot more questions, but I'm afraid if we go down that, rabbit hole, we're going to be here for a while. So let's wrap it up. What is the best way that folks can get in touch with you, man?
Yeah, if anyone's on Twitter, you know, I'm the most active there at Brian Beers. I'm also working on building LinkedIn. So if someone hangs out there more, it's good. I've got a podcast as well. It's called Business with Beers. I talk a lot about, you know, franchising. I talk a lot about, you know, how do we simplify business, right? To make kind of business ownership more accessible. I think there's a lot of people think it's super complicated and they're afraid to get started. But at the end of the day, you know, none of us know exactly what to do. We're just like willing to take risks and figure it out as we go. And if we don't know, we find people who can help us, right? And so, and that's the cool thing about franchising and why that helps simplify the path to business ownership, which I'm a huge proponent of. So those would kind of be the best resources for people.
I will add one thing. That's refreshing to hear you say that really before you do it, nobody really knows what they're doing. Because so many people think, well, I could never do that, because they obviously know what they're doing and they're talented and they have a higher tolerance for risk and all this stuff. And you can use all the excuses in the world, but I'll just leave it at that. Like, I appreciate you saying that, and I appreciate you being vulnerable on that point. So, folks, if you want to reach out to Brian Beers, he's got a podcast. Check him out on Twitter. And I think that wraps it up. Bobby, anything else?
No, thanks. Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it. This has been super helpful. And man, we'll be rooting for you guys. Appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
As we conclude this episode of the Good Endeavor Business Show, Bobby and I would like to extend our gratitude for joining us on this insightful journey. Remember, whether in business or life, every endeavor holds profound meaning. Your pursuit of excellence and service contributes to a purposeful narrative. Until next time, keep thriving in all your endeavors.